This week, a Kauai-based group of organizations and individuals filed a lawsuit against the State Department of Land and Natural Resources and agribusiness company Syngenta. At issue is a permit granted to Syngenta for the use of a parcel of coastal crown land that was given without either an environmental assessment or an impact statement as required by Hawaii statute. I sat down yesterday with the head of one of the organizations who brought the suit. Gary Hooser is president of the Hawaii Alliance for Progressive Action Board of Directors, and I asked him to explain why the Hui believes DLNR acted in error.
Well, these lands are particularly sensitive. Chapter 343 in Hawaii state law is very clear that all use of state resources lands have to have an environmental review, but especially lands that are crown lands on the coast and close to endangered species, that kind of thing.
So in cases such as this, with the leasing of crown lands, there is an actual requirement for an environmental assessment?
There's a requirement for an environmental review of all public lands when they're used for any kind of action or development. The review has different stages, and some can be declared exempt if the reviewer, in this case the Department of Land and Natural Resources, thinks that there's no impact. They can exempt it, which is what they've done. If they don't exempt it, then it should have an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement. That's a law that applies to all state lands.
Why do you think that they gave that nod to Syngenta and didn't go through the review process?
I think that historically they have just treated industrial agriculture and factory farming the same as they've treated every other type of agriculture and didn't take into consideration the high-level use of pesticides and the nature of this industry on those very sensitive coastal lands that are actually zoned conservation.
Even in the face of all that we've seen over the last several years with the challenges mounted from Kauai?
Well, it is frustrating, and the law applies when a lease or a permit is granted. So the vast majority of these leases and permits have been in place for a while. So this is a new action, which therefore triggers the law. And they have required EISs for other forms of non-traditional agriculture, if you would, tree farming, aquaculture, and other very intensive. A dairy farm on Kauai was just required to do an EIS.
Even though these are crown lands and that sensitivity has been there for a very long time, why do you think that that same rubric wasn't applied to those crown lands originally?
The way the transition of use happened, it was plantation lands, sugar lands. And then when they left, the seed companies moved in. And so it was a gradual metamorphosis, if you would. And the seed companies then gave way to these chemical companies that are actually doing experimentation and using a lot heavier chemicals. And frankly, I don't think anyone's asked at this point, because I was a former director of the Office of Environmental Quality Control. I'm very familiar with the law, and I just kept thinking, how come they're not doing it? How come they're not doing it? And then when an opportunity came to ask that question properly, that's what we're doing right now.
So I hear you saying that nobody really had the vision to see that this might move in that direction as the lands transferred from owner or user to another user.
Absolutely. As you know, in the old days, plantations ruled our state, and certainly they ruled Kauai. And so no one really wanted to challenge them back then, I'm sure. And as time moves forward, the industry has changed.
When did you find out about this permit?
I found out about the permit about 2 months ago. I look at the agendas that various state agencies issue, Department of Land and Natural Resources, the Agribusiness Development Corporation. The state actually leases and controls about 10,000 acres on the west side of Kauai. And the vast majority of these acreage is in use by these chemical companies.
Was there any way of finding out about it as the permit was being applied for?
Yes, absolutely there was. And I actually submitted testimony requesting that they do a proper environmental review, an EA or an EIS.
So in knowing that they were applying for this permit, asking for them to do the review, then seeing that it was, that part of it at least was denied and that the permit was granted, it's taken you now, 4 months to be able to get together with a Hui and then challenge this. Why so long when you knew that this was coming?
Well, it's the first time I've ever been involved in a formal action like this. And it takes several elements that are important. It takes knowledge of the law. It takes attorneys. You have to find attorneys who agree that this is a problem and that they feel they have a good case. So that took some time. We have to raise money to pay the attorneys, and there has to be a collection of plaintiffs, people in the community who also want to share your effort. And so that takes some time. It's been less than 120 days. 120 days is the time frame in which action has to be filed.
Nobody wanted to take this on pro bono.
Well, a lot of people are doing good work pro bono. Earth Justice has several actions right now, multiple actions around the state pro bono, and other law firms are doing pro bono actions. On this one, we have a public interest attorney, Lance Collins, who's very, very good, but he's a small shop, if you would, and has expenses and needs to be paid. So we're fortunate that we've been able to raise the funds so far and are optimistic that as we go forward, we'll be able to continue raising the money.
Kauai has gone head-to-head now with the seed industry for quite some time, and specifically over its use of pesticides on genetically engineered crops. There's been a point of stopping every time or being turned back every time. What makes you believe that this challenge will be more successful than those in the past?
You know, actually, Beth Ann, I think the ones in the past have been successful when you put them in the light of the impact on the community. We have less land now being used by these companies where I live, and their crops and fields are further away from homes, houses, schools, and they're using less pesticides than they were 4 years ago. So even though we lost in court, I believe we're still winning in terms of positive impacts on our community. Maui also is involved in this effort, and people here on the North Shore of Oahu also. I believe the fundamental aspect of this that makes it different is that the law is very clear. I mean, again, I served as director of the office responsible for administering this law. It's very clear that the impacts have to be evaluated, and it's very clear that these have not. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs weighed in on it and said they were concerned about possible burials. If you look, the Department of Health has on file records from Syngenta that the Syngenta themselves say that the activities are occurring in critical habitat areas where endangered species exist. It's very, very clear that the law applies. And I believe if you look closely, and I'm hopeful if the court looks closely, they will see that, yes, I think we need a higher level of scrutiny. This is coastal lands. This is lands just a couple hundred feet, if that, from the beach and from reefs. And the pesticides are very toxic, and they're prone to drift, either in the soil, in the water, or in the air.
What do you think will have to happen before the state is able to see this and apply this universally? Because as you've said earlier, you testified about this. They certainly knew about it and saw in their minds that it didn't apply. How do you think it has to go to the courts or perhaps have something happen within the state that makes more of these cases less likely to come to the point where this one is with a lawsuit?
No, I agree. I think it's fundamentally a case of education, a lack of education by many, many people that is stymied by the industry's lack of disclosure. Because they have refused to disclose their complete impacts, both restricted-use pesticides, general-use pesticides, and the crops they're growing, it's impossible to determine the impacts. I believe once a thorough environmental assessment or environmental impact statement is conducted, then that will be valuable information to determine what are the impacts. You know, are they really impacting the reefs or endangered species or the people? And once we have that, that'll be good information that the director of the DLNR and other Department of Health and Department of Ag will have that information, as well as the governor and legislators. But up until this point, we have not had the information, and that has been very frustrating for many people, including myself.
It sounds in a way that you're saying that the industry has hoodwinked the state. Are you?
Absolutely. Hoodwinked is a strong word. I believe the industry has a conscious and deliberate strategy to withhold information and to manipulate the administration, state administration, and legislators to keep further regulation from occurring. I think that's a natural response from a major corporation like this who is dealing with chemicals that have potential and the reality of great harm to health and the environment. It is no secret that what they're using, chlorpyrifos, is a neurotoxin the EPA until just recently was going to ban. It's the same chemical that 10 workers were exposed to that the EPA is fining Syngenta for $4.8 million. That company does not want this information out. They do not want increased regulation, and they're doing everything they can to keep that from happening.
As you just mentioned, the EPA decided not to ban it. So the fallback position is, look, it's perfectly legal.
Well, we have a new president in town, And unfortunately, he and his directors are rolling back many, many environmental protections. And I believe that's even more reason for our state and our community to step up and to say, even though we have an EPA director and a president who denies climate change, for example, or denies that we need to regulate chlorpyrifos, as a state, we need to step up and say, no, we believe the protection of health and the environment comes first, regardless of the position of the federal government.
Well, we're going to see if that happens
when this goes
to court. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Gary Hooser is president of the Hawaii Alliance for Progressive Action's Board of Directors. HAPA is one of the plaintiffs in the suit against the state of Hawaii and Syngenta.
The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, life aboard the Hokulea and what it means with Na'alehu Anthony. But first, your quiz. Earlier in the week, we took a virtual tour of the Honolulu Botanical Gardens. If you take a stroll down to the intersection of Nu'uanu Avenue and North Vineyard Boulevard, you'll find yourself near the Foster Botanical Garden. Foster is one of the five separate gardens that make up the Honolulu Botanical Gardens, and this urban oasis dates back to 1853, when Queen Kalama leased a part of the land to a young German doctor. He was as much a botanist as he was a physician, and he planted several of the now gargantuan trees towering over the garden's upper terrace. The property was later sold to Thomas and Mary Foster, who continued to develop the garden. Following Mary Foster's death in 1930, the lot was bequeathed to the city of Honolulu to be preserved as a public garden. For our quiz, we'd like to know if you can tell us the name of the German doctor who originally leased and tended the land. Here's a hint. He was the author of a text, Flora of the Hawaiian Islands, published in 1888. And as you're listening to the rebroadcast of The Conversation, we won't be taking any calls to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us at 11 a.m. when we're live.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
Na'alehu Anthony is a Hokulea crew member. He's also chief executive director of O'iwi TV, responsible for documentation and website content for the Malamahonua voyage. It's so great to have Na'alehu Anthony here. Mahalo to you and the crew at O'iwi for taking us all on the voyage.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been really it's our honor. This has been the chance of a lifetime to be able to spend this much time with the canoe and get to go to these places we'd never get to go.
So awesome. And then you get those moments like the Potomac.
Oh my gosh. You know?
Were you thinking George Washington at all in the back of your mind?
We went right by his house, Mount Vernon. We went right by there. On the left-hand side on the hill, there's Mount Vernon. And then on the right is Piscataway. All the native peoples. Some tribes hadn't come together for many decades, but they did for us, to welcome us to this place.
How did that happen? Was it your ed team advance work there that got the word?
You know, I honestly believe it has to do with the mana of the canoe at the base of it. And so when people hear about the canoe coming, they put their best version of themselves forward and they come with aloha all over the world. And so when you get to a place like Piscataway, the idea of the canoe and this audacious dream of this canoe that's coming around the long way to the East Coast inspired everyone to say, hey, we need to welcome these people the proper way. One of the things that I really admire about the voyage, now looking back on it a little bit, is that we always asked the First Nations peoples from these different places for permission to come. We never said we're coming. We said, would it be a good idea to come? Is it possible for us to come to honor the native peoples of this place? And that out in the East Coast is something that's rare. Like these guys had said, nobody had asked for permission to come to this place they were saying hundreds of years, right? And So this was an opportunity, I think, to celebrate Native knowledge. Certainly an opportunity to look at the ways at which we are more common than we are different. And so it ended up bringing a lot of people together to make it all happen, because the effort to coordinate it is massive, right? I mean, I just sailed last week 2,500 miles, the same route that would have been sailed.
I just got off the canoe.
The same route for the first time for me that was sailed for thousands of years to get people here, to bring all of our ancestors here. And it's far. There's no land in between the two. It's far and it's open. And I'm wondering the same question on board a canoe a couple of weeks ago that you just asked, like, what were they doing out here?
Where did they think they were going? I mean, when we go out into space, we can kind of see the point we're going for.
Well, I mean, and I guess I would say that the power of observation is that they could see those points, that the ability for Nainoa's teacher, Maupialuk, to see the clues is entirely different than what the students now see, right? The depth of knowledge, the understanding. I mean, I've seen him do it. I saw him do it.
What's that like, Na'alehu?
It's like...
Is he reading the world with his body?
Yeah, it's like watching these navigators on this last trip observe and learn and find direction and struggle and then get to the end of 2,500 miles and be just a few miles off. Means to me, like, this is this amazing turn of events that has been building for really thousands of years, really.
At the last, there always seems to be something like faith or trust in there.
Yeah. The day we found land, we're sailing and sailing, and we get to the morning meeting. We hadn't seen land the day before. We knew we were in the box of where land was. And Bruce Blankenfeld, who's a Poe navigator, he came on as like the sailmaster, as like the teacher, basically. He doesn't say anything the whole trip, right? He won't give any navigational clues. He just, you know, he just let the navigators do their thing. And he says, you know, the one piece of advice I have for you guys today is patience. Just be patient. We know it's there. Just wait. It's going to come to you. The land will come to you. And so we're waiting and everybody's watching and there's this humming energy, right? There's this anticipation, right?
You're all looking in the same direction.
No, we found out, like, we know land's below us. We know we're above the big island, right? That by strategy, we knew we were above the big island. We fanned out and we're looking around. And everybody's watching, and then there's this huge bank of clouds below us, and we know the big island's under there, but you can't say, oh, that cloud is land. You have to see the land in order to call it. And then out in front of us, there's this dark, dark, faint, super faint shadow. So we're watching it, and the shadow doesn't move. So it's not a cloud. All day it's just sitting there. And as we get closer, you can start to see the defined edge. And then finally, we call it. We say, okay, that's land. And it can't be the big island. It has to be Haleakala because of where we know we are, how high we are. And so everybody celebrates a little bit and we call it. And so then at that point, the strategy changes, right? We say, okay, we found land. We know it's Maui. The navigational experiment is over, and so we take a plot. We want to know where we are on a lat-long plot because they want to start to do the measurements to where we got to go, and also they want to know how far out they were. So Bruce calls Nainoa on a satellite phone, and he says, hey, we saw Maui, Haleakala, and this long pause. And Nainoa says, no way, you're too far away. And Bruce says, no, we see it. Nainoa says, I'm watching you guys on the tracker. You guys are too far away. And Bruce says, well, we just took a picture of it. We're going to send it to you. fire up the satellite. I sent it over, and there's this Mona in the frame, right? Sent over, and he calls back, and he's like, "You guys, this is like the math is impossible, and yet there's this island sitting there looking for you, waiting for you." That when we took the plot, we were 130 miles away from the island. There's these books that say the height of the mountain versus, you know, the climate that you're in is going to give you a range, a circle of how far away you can see that thing. They're saying like these mountains, the farthest you can see them is 120 miles. But they had seen it all morning, right? Yeah, I don't know. Unexplainable, but it's just the mana of the voyage. Again and again and again, you see these things.
Hmm. Yeah. Can you take us on board, maybe to a nighttime there? Because I have a feeling that you stand out in the sky at night and you're different than we are.
Yeah. For the last 20 years of sailing, I've only stood one watch. It's the 2-6 watch. Uh-huh. So it's 2-6 in the afternoon, and then it's 2-6 in the morning. And the reason why I stand that watch is because as a photographer, it means that I'll be up for every sunrise and sunset and golden hour. And so I'll shoot in and around those times. But the 2-6 watch is my favorite because you come up at 2 a.m. And everybody goes down. And so there's only three or four of you on the deck.
What are you supposed to be doing?
Our primary job is to hold the course. In the Northern Hemisphere, the North Star was right in front of us. We could see the Southern Cross would be almost setting behind us. We would have Maui's Fishhook off our port stern. And then the one thing that we waited for every morning was we would just wait for Venus to rise on our starboard beam. And Venus is really, really bright in the morning. And so even when it was cloudy, you could still see the glow of Venus before the glow of the sun came up and the sun filled the sky. And so Venus is a great navigational marker, a great navigational tool. So a lot of times we would use Venus for hours at a time and just steer and just hold the course.
Does living in Hawaii mean anything different after a trip like this?
Mm. You know, we have this male lady up at our place at our office, you know, and she knows we're the guys that working on the voyage. And so I saw her just before I left on this trip. And she says, "Hey, okay, I'm going to take a vacation. Where's the best place you went?" She tells me, "Where's the best place, right?"
You should know.
And I go, "Auntie, you know what? This is the most beautiful place right here. All these places we went, incredible stories, incredible people, but we kind of take Hawaii for granted. This is the most beautiful place." And so to answer your question, right, we come back and it's like I come back more fierce in wanting to protect this place and take care of it. And then the spirit of what comes out in the canoe is like, it's not woe is me, what are we going to do? It's like, let's figure it out. They figured out how to get here. They figured out how to hang out here for a couple of thousand years. Let's figure out what's next. Let's figure out how to do it together as an island community, as a place that has been resilient for all these thousands of years. And we'll figure it out.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Alejo. Thank you for having me. This is, I haven't really had any time to reflect until just now.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Na'alehu Anthony is the Chief Executive Director of OEV-TV, which will broadcast Hokulea's arrival live tomorrow on their website and on cable television. Na'alehu takes you further on the voyage in an extended interview at hawaiipublicradio.org. Now, the homecoming. Hokulea's homecoming tomorrow at Magic Island starts at 7 a.m. The actual arrival set for 9 a.m. There's a day-long program there at Magic Island, and the Malamahonua Summit begins Sunday and runs through Tuesday. That's at the Hawaii Convention Center. The Hokulea will be docked in the Alawai, and you will be able to board.
Hokulea, star of gladness.
Hi, I'm Brian Guadagno from Raw Elements Certified Natural Sunscreen. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in Apple App Store or Google Play.
It's a Friday, and one of the things we like to do is take a look at what's going on in our news department and what we all will be hearing come Monday and into the week. To help us with that preview, Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, joins us now. And we are just listening to that wonderful story about Hokulea. And the big story this weekend, obviously, is Hokulea.
Yeah, aloha, Bethann. That really is true. Just the magic of Hokulea is going to continue to drift over the weekend and into the early part of next week. As Noe mentioned, in terms of OIVI TV, this is quite something that they are going to be having a live three-camera switch shoot. And also, by the way, you can get to that by way of a post that we'll put up as well. They've been our partners with us along the way. 3 years we've been covering the voyage of the Hokulea and checking in with crew members along the way, and a lot of that is thanks to their good work as well. And we're going to be compiling some highlights of our Hokulea coverage, that extended interview that Noe mentioned, and some other ones that she has done as well, all on our website. If you go to the News and Talk tab, there's a drop-down menu for series and specials, and you can find Hokulea, Voyage of Aloha as part of that. And, of course, Ku'uwehi is going to be covering that itself. She'll wrap that all up for Monday morning morning edition listeners, have the latest on that, and, again, just following up through the week, really, on that as well.
Didn't she also take a look at some of the trails in Hawaii? Yeah. Some of the ones that maybe we shouldn't be knowing about.
Well, that whole concept of managed access to trails, it's an interesting story. And it's one of these stories that's great that, you know, sometimes in news you jump into something and you say, oh, wait, there's more to this story. Oh, you know what? It's going to take a little longer to do this. Oh, let's break this into some more coverage. And I love when that happens, because that shows that the stories that you get into have legs themselves and sort of grow and widen. And this is definitely one of those cases, and we'll hear more on that from next week as well.
Unless we forget about rail.
Couldn't forget about rail, right? So HART Board meets next week, the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, in case you lost your scorecard at home. Finances on the agenda, as you might expect, but one of the interesting points on this is specifically cash flow. So, again, in terms of what updates we may hear, what this is going to be like in terms of framing the discussion of where we go. Interesting timing, Mayor Caldwell just coming back from Washington, D.C. Again, keeping an eye on HART, big part of what we're going to continue to do as well.
Thanks so much. We'll look forward to all of that.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director, and he joins us every Friday with a preview of the coming week.
Sorry, I'm not home, I know I'm walking in this battle. If you leave a message and I'll call you back. Oh, like a storybook. Leave a message and I'll call you back.
Okay, you know, another of the things that we do on a Friday is to take a look at your letters and emails and your posts on social media.
Mm-hmm. In response to last Friday's listener's comment, Bethann, it was, remember we were talking about the ban of compostable bags on Maui. Marge Bonar checked in on that one. The bag reduction ordinance, she says, was not poorly written. It was as close to perfect as we could get the political agreement behind it. The bags marketed as compostable plastic bags are only broken down in very specific conditions in highly specialized commercial compost facilities. None of these currently exist in the islands. The Maui ban also required reusable bags to be 3 mil, heavy enough for repeated use, unlike the thinner designation for bags the other counties adopted. She claims the only flaw in the Maui bill was not to require a fee for all bags given to customers.
Following Wednesday's look at the Oxford study on the effects of moderate alcohol consumption on brain health, Andrea DaCosta said this on Twitter. Brain chemistry is affected by many things, including what we ingest physically and mentally. Cognitive dissonance may contribute to alcoholism.
I think I know what she's talking about, Beth. Thanks for the feedback, by the way. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or just call our talkback line, 792-8217.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
It's an undeniable fact of being human. Hunger never takes a holiday. For kids in summer school, being hungry doesn't take a vacation either. A national organization, the Food Research and Action Center, has released its state rankings of the reach of summer nutrition programs. Although Hawaii is neither in the top nor the worst ranked states, our state jumped from number 47 to number 37 on the list. Nicole Wu is the Senior Policy Analyst at the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice, and she joins us now with some of the reasons for Hawaii's much better ranking this year. Welcome.
Oh, aloha, Bethann.
Good to talk to you again. Part of this good news story is the fact that there's been a concerted effort to be growing the program. How many children do we serve now?
The report looks at summer of 2016, and we were serving 767 low-income children and youth last summer. That's about 11% of the free and reduced-price lunch kids. It's a great improvement, but there's definitely room for more improvement.
All true, and we'll get to that in a moment, but the fact that we saw a 25% increase in the number from last year, to what do you attribute that?
Yeah, the report actually highlighted Hawaii in the national report, which I think is a great honor for our state. There were some meetings put together in the spring of 2016 by the Department of Education, inviting the partners who need to be serving these meals to kids. Because in the summertime, kids are not at school. We don't have cafeteria workers. So you have to have partnerships between programs that are providing activities for low-income kids and combine them with people who can actually make these meals up to the nutritional standards. So this meeting last spring had Parks and Recs and YMCAs and the Department of Education and food vendors like Kapi'olani Community College's culinary department. And First Lady Dawn Ige was there to add her her prestige and to encourage all of these groups to work together. And I think their coordination efforts are paying off in a really, really tangible way.
And we hadn't seen a coordination effort like this in years past.
It was a new thing. We've seen 2 years of really good improvement. Over 1,000 keiki added to the program for two summers in a row. So if we can continue doing that, I think it'll be a great thing for all of our kids.
Not to take the shine off of this very good news, there's still the reality of how many kids are not served. Is that still, you know, 8 out of 9 children who are not?
Right. So this report looks at low-income kids who are getting free or reduced price during the school year, and then they look at how many of them are getting free summer meals through this federal program. And even though we did go up in the rankings by 10 spots, we're still serving less than 1 in 9 of our low-income students during the summer. So that's 8 out of 9 free or reduced price lunch kids in the summertime where we just don't know what they're eating. But since they are from low-income families, they're probably not getting the most nutritious meals. If their parents are able to serve them full meals all summer, it's a strain on the family's budget because during the school year, they're used to getting the meals at school. So there is a concern about what the other 8 out of 9 kids are getting in the summer.
And if that includes fruit and vegetables and some of the other things that they may be getting when they're at school and they have lunch or breakfast at school.
That's right. This summer nutrition program, the federal program, provides reimbursements to nonprofits or food vendors who can make these meals for low-income kids. And these meals have the same type of nutrition standards as the school lunch program has. And those standards actually improved greatly during the Obama administration. It was a real priority of Michelle Obama to make the meals much more healthy.
And aren't we seeing the weakening of some of those at the moment?
Unfortunately, the current administration is rolling back some of the improvements that were seen during the Obama administration, making some of these strong nutrition standards more optional for schools. And that's certainly a concern for people who care about obesity and the health of children's diets.
What do you think that means for Hawaii, since there's been such a push to have more locally grown food show up on a kid's plate?
I think there are some great things happening in Hawaii. At the Kohala Complex on the Big Island, they're doing a great farm-to-school project where they're trying to find new ways to source local food, create menus that are culturally appropriate, that kids would actually
friendly
like.
Because the kids are involved with that.
Yes,
right?
And I've heard great things. They are getting the feedback of the kids. This spring, I've heard that there were certain meals like the lau lau at lunchtime where the kids were running to the cafeteria. That program, which is headed up by Lieutenant Governor Susui, is going to be expanding to Maui next year. So that's a great thing happening here in Hawaii. So despite the fact that the current administration in Washington is weakening nutrition standards, here in Hawaii we can continue to push forward.
Between the time that this report came out this month and the next time that we see it, what would you hope would happen to be able to not only just increase the ranking, because that sounds nice, but the bottom line is, how do we feed more kids?
Yes, continuing the type of efforts that were highlighted in this report is the key. As I mentioned, summer food is a harder program to run than school lunch because you have to find programs where low-income kids are going to and make sure that they're serving meals. And then you also have to make sure that kids are even going to these programs. So one thing that we found is that if you provide a free meal that kids like at a summer program, children are more likely to go to it. And that helps reduce academic slide in the summer, which is a real thing. All kids of any income level show some fallback in their academics during the summer. But it's shown to be a much larger gap for low-income kids, and it causes them to fall further and further behind every year. So these sort of enrichment programs, if we can get more low-income keiki into them, the gap in achievement will be lessened between low-income children and their higher-income peers.
So what's being done now to create some more of these networks and more, you know, people who would be partners?
Mm-hmm. We need to have more of these meetings. I think there's a good momentum right now, and hopefully, you know, people like the First Lady will continue to put their celebrity, I guess, behind it, the Department of Education, and all kind of programs that serve youth. You know, churches have programs in the summer for low-income kids. You know, libraries have reading programs. So finding all those programs and connecting them with summer food, making sure they know it's available, and finding vendors who can provide the meals, it's very important because these programs that are serving kids often feel like they can't take on one more thing. So they will often say they can't figure out how to provide the meals. So making these connections between those who can make the food and transport the meals and the summer programs is very important.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing what happens and hope that we see even better rankings the next time we talk about it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
The bottom line, feeding more hungry kids. Nicole Wu is a senior policy analyst at the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. She focuses on issues that affect low-income Hawaii residents, including hunger, wage inequality, and tax fairness. In the latest Food Research and Action Center rankings of state summer school lunch programs, Hawaii jumped this year from number 47 to 37.
In our backyard quiz today, we took a walk around a small botanical oasis in the middle of urban Honolulu. The Foster Garden has a history dating back to 1853 when Queen Kalama leased it to a young German doctor. He was both a physician and a botanist, and he made it a point to apply his green thumb to the ground surrounding his home. To this day, several of the trees he planted tower over the property's upper terrace. The land was later sold to Thomas and Mary Foster. They bequeathed it to the city of Honolulu, and to this day, it remains a public park named in their honor, Foster Gardens. For today's quiz, we wanted you to tell us the name of the German doctor who originally tended the plot and who wrote Flora of the Hawaiian Islands. The answer is William Hillebrand.
And Matthew Keir called us from Honolulu. Says he listens every day, new today's quiz, and is today's winner. Thanks so much for calling. And if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from Achieve 3000, wishing all students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve Hawaii Home Access. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
What a pleasure to introduce Cindy Goldstein. She's a PhD plant biologist and a certified homebrew judge for the last 18 years. She's also event planner for HOPS. Although that's, what does HOPS stand for, Cindy?
HOPS stands for Homebrewers on Pacific Shores, and that's our homebrew club here on Oahu. We have more than one homebrew club on Oahu, and HOPS has been around for about almost 15 years now.
All right. Well, this is quite a subculture that we're going to be introduced to here, the beer drinkers on Oahu anyway. And we thought we'd find out a little bit about beer to begin with. Cindy, I do not know a thing about beer. So we've got a little bit of a tasting in front of us. Beth Ann, you're joining us. Okay.
Terrific. Well, beer judging is something that comes under the Beer Judge Certification Program. A lot of home brewers, you know, brew for fun and brew what they like. And some brewers like to enter the beer into competitions. Mm-hmm. And so there's actually an organization that does help certify beer judges. And they also have developed guidelines for what a particular type of beer should have in terms of taste and aroma and different characteristics. So are we ready to jump right in?
I guess so.
Okay. So we have with us here today a red ale, which is an amber ale, and we also have a porter. So the red ale is a locally owned brewery from Mehana over on Hawaii Island.
Right.
In and in beer judging terms, we would call this an amber ale.
Okay.
So I have in front of me some guidelines from the Beer Judge Certification Program. The first thing we do is aroma, because once you taste it, you have a hard time with aroma. So we're going to give it a sniff. And I smell something kind of sweet. Mm-hmm. And not too much in the way of hops. So for an amber ale, we would expect to have kind of a malty sweetness in its character, which I perceive. Do you perceive that?
Is that malt? I'm not sure.
Yes,
I'm
that's
smelling.
Malt.
Some
that's something sweet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not too much hops. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we're going to take a sip.
Mm.
And we don't spit it out like sorts of things. We get to actually taste it. And in this case, you know, again, it's got a bit of a malty character, a
what
sweetness.
What is that malt flavor? What is that?
It comes from the barley, mm-hmm. and you can have different sorts of descriptions. For in this case, it's more of a caramel kind of toffee. Other descriptions for malt might be biscuit, toffee, caramel, bread-like. And then you get some darker sorts of tastes, a chocolate, a coffee. So in this case, it's sort of a sweet kind of smooth malt taste, which is something we'd expect in an amber ale. We also look at the color when we do beer judging. And this is sort of a reddish color. They call it a red ale, and an amber should have sort of a reddish color. So we also look at the balance. So sometimes we'll say, is there more hops? Do we taste and smell different types of hop, resin, piney, fruity, floral. So we use a lot of descriptors for what we're perceiving. And people have different taste perception and perception for smell. And not everybody can taste and smell some of the characteristics.
Okay.
But that is what we're looking for, and we're looking for that balance.
This is a much darker beer.
This
right
is
here.
A much darker beer. This is from Lanikai Brewing over in Kailua, and this is their pillbox porter. So, again, we'll give this a sniff. And for a porter, we would expect to have a little bit more of a chocolate, maybe a coffee, again, kind of toffee or grainy. Do you get any of those?
That's, already I'm happy, yes. Yeah.
But can we taste it now?
No. Now we can taste it. And often the taste is very similar to the aroma.
It's kind of almost, yeah, there's a little coffee-ishness in there.
And chocolate.
Chocolate.
And there's a fullness and a richness.
Yes.
So and the mouthfeel, yeah, you're right.
And you've picked up one of the other things that we talk about as a descriptor, the mouthfeel. Is it full-bodied? Is it medium-body? Do I taste in the balance more sweet, more alcohol, more hops? So this is a very nice example of a porter where we're getting some very good sorts of tastes in the malt. And by malt, we usually mean barley and other grains that are added. And
so these
not so
are the
much
kinds
hops.
Of characteristics and ingredients that home brewers juggle to make just exactly the kind of drink they want, right?
Yes, and it's an exciting time for home brewing and craft beer brewing because what we see is a lot more emphasis on local ingredients. So, for instance, Lanikai Brewing has explored putting in ingredients like hibiscus or lemongrass or other sorts of local ingredients. We'll see coconut added to beer. So there's an emphasis, just as in many other realms, to have local ingredients as well as foundation styles of traditional beer styles.
So Lanikai, they've got a brew pub?
So Lanikai is more of a brewery. You
I
can
see.
Go and taste and then purchase growlers and bottles. They
growlers.
Mostly
do you know what that is? I just found out the other day. A whole English word I never heard of.
You get to bring your own and fill it up.
Yes, you get to bring your own.
Think of it as a tiny keg.
About half gallon, although I was just recently over on Hawaii Island at Big Island Brew House.
Okay.
And they will actually also sell you their wonderful craft brew that they'll sell you in a little canning jar, which you can bring your canning jar and get that refilled as well.
Oh, gosh, that's just adorable, right? Look, now there's a homebrew scene on every island, I've just found out. And there also is a terrific beer pub scene on Oahu. What are some of the places and what are the characteristics that you could just point to quickly?
So we've been looking at whether the scene would grow here over time. It has in many other parts of the country, and we're seeing a real growth of that now in the support of our local craft brewers. The Aloha Beer Company, which is on Queen Street, recently opened. That is a venture. Dave Campbell is the brewer there, excellent brewer, and he was the original brewer at Sam Choi's and also was the homebrew store owner way in the early days. So he went from being a home brewer to being a commercial brewer, and we see that quite a bit.
People are loving that place, I notice.
And then Lanikai Brewing, we mentioned, they've been very supportive of the local homebrew community, doing a lot with local ingredients, and their emphasis in their brewery was on energy efficiency and capture of energy and to be very conscious of that in their design of their brewery. We have Beer Lab, which is near the university, near University and King. They're doing a lot of experimental beers, as their name would indicate, with different strains of yeast, different ingredients. We have Waikiki Brewing, which is at the right at the start of Ala Moana Boulevard in Waikiki.
Oh,
and
that
that's a very good brewery, nice local brewery. And again, use of local ingredients, different sorts of types of beers. And you always look at your local customers. We usually have a desire to have something for the beer connoisseurs, the beer geeks that like, you know, lots of hops or lots of different sorts of things in their brews, or a lighter kind of golden ale. So
and
we're seeing an explosion of this here.
Oh, my gosh, we are. And we've got to talk more about this. But our time is waning. So you're using your plant PhD right now, possibly in service of local brewers. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. So the Hawaii Department of Agriculture has sponsored a local grant to look at surveying the ability to grow hops here in Hawaii and to share that with people that are interested, farmers that might be interested in growing hops. So I'm certainly interested, and we have this up on the website, I believe, of people who have grown hops in the past, successfully or not so successfully, very interested in that. And we're going to be reaching out to local farmers, beginning farmers, socially disadvantaged farmers, and current farmers to see if there's interest in growing hops here in Hawaii.
Woo-hoo! Thanks so much, Cindy. We'll have to talk again. Dr. Cindy Goldstein's currently overseeing a Hawaii Department of Agriculture-funded project to study growing hops in Hawaii, and she's planning the next hops event on Oahu.
And thank you for the chance to join you today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
As we're sitting here enjoying some of the notes of chocolate and other good things in that porter, we're going to say goodbye for the week. On Monday, new research on deadly heat waves and a look at the long-term care scorecard.
Plus, a Renshi poetry team's tackled the Masikaha Hawaii case with surprising results. And scholar Noinoi Silva shares her new book, Exploring Native Hawaiian Intellectual History.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line anytime you like and leave us your comments. Here's the number. It's 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation. Tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any part of this show, The Conversation, or anything else we air, you can find them all on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store and Google Play. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Koslovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
The A-Team and the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up The Conversation. Have a great weekend.